Brainwashing. Her jaw fell open, as if she were appalled that he could even suggest it. Then a fire stoked behind her eyes. Why? Are you worried that you may have had actual feelings for a lowly cyborg? I'm just trying to figure out what was real and who this person is. He gestured from her head to her toes. One day, you're fixing port screens at the market. The next, you're breaking out of a high-security prison. And now, you've disabled my palace security, you're waving a knife at me, and you're threatening to tranquilize my chief advisor if you don't get what you want. What am I supposed to think? I don't even know whose side you're on. Cinder clenched her fists, but as his angry words settled, her eyes caught on something over his shoulder. The enormous picture window overlooking the Eastern Commonwealth. Her expression became distant, calculating. She took another step toward him. Kai flinched. I'm on my side, she said. And if you want what's best for the Commonwealth and this entire planet, you'd better be on my side too. She held out her hand, palm up. Now, give me your wrist. He curled his fingers. My responsibility is here. I have a country to protect. I'm not running away from that. And I'm certainly not running away with you. He tried to lift his chin, though it was difficult when Cinder's glare was making him feel about as important as a grain of salt. Really? She drawled. You'd rather take your chances with her? At least I know when she's manipulating me. Newsflash, I have never manipulated you. And I hope I never have to. But you aren't the only one with responsibilities and an entire country of people who are relying on you. So I'm sorry, Your Majesty, but you are coming with me. And you're just going to have to figure out whether or not you can trust me when we're not so pressed for time. Then she raised her hand and shot him. Chapter 52. Within seconds of the dart hitting Kai's chest, his eyelids fluttered closed and he collapsed into cinder. The advisor yelped and stood, but Aiko intercepted him, pressing the man back as Cinder eased Kai's unconscious body onto the floor. For a moment, she was paralyzed, her mind reeling from the things she'd just said, at what she'd just done.
Cinder, are you all right?
Said Aiko. Fine, she muttered, trembling as she propped Kai against the table and pulled out the dart. He's going to hate me when he wakes up, but I'm fine. She couldn't help glancing up again, at the big picture window hung with heavy silk drapes, at her own reflection looking back at her, at the girl with one metal hand wearing the uniform of a servant. She let out a slow, head-clearing breath and pulled Kai's hand toward her. What are you going to do to him? Cinder paused long enough to look over at the advisor. His face was red with fury. We're taking him somewhere safe, she said. Somewhere Lavanna can't get to him. And you think there won't be repercussions for that? Not only for you, but for everyone on this planet. Don't you realize that we are in the middle of a war? We're not in the middle of a war. We're at the very beginning, she fixed her gaze on him. And I'm going to put an end to it.
She can put an end to it, said Aiko. We have a plan, and His Majesty will be safe with us.
Strangely embarrassed by Aiko's confidence, Cinder refocused on Kai's wrist. She'd cut out so many ID chips in the past weeks, she was almost used to it, though the first incision still reminded her of Peony's limp hand and blue fingertips. Every time. A thick drop of blood welled up on his skin, and Cinder instinctively tilted his arm so that it would roll down his fingers without soiling his white shirt.
He believes that you've found the lost Princess Celine.
She paused and, after a beat, glanced up at Aiko, then at the advisor.
He... what?
Is it true? Have you found her?
Gulping, she refocused on Kai's wrist, waited until her hands stopped trembling before she removed the small chip from his flesh.
Yes, she said, her voice wary as she fished some clean bandages from her calf compartment and wrapped them around the wound. She's with us.
Then you also believe she can make a difference.
Her teeth clenched, but she forced herself to relax as she secured the bandages.
She will make a difference. The people of Luna are going to rally around her. She's going to reclaim her throne.
Retracting the knife blade, she met the advisor's glare again.
But if this wedding goes through, it won't matter. No revolution on Luna is going to nullify a marriage and a coronation. If you give her this power, there's nothing I or anyone can do to take it from her. And I know that you're smart enough to see the repercussions of that.
With a sigh, Cinder rolled down her pant leg again and stood up.
I understand that you have no reason to trust me, but I'm going to ask you to anyway. I promise no harm will come to Kai while he's with us.
She was met with silence and a simmering glare. She nodded.
Fair enough.
Aiko? Aiko stooped and grabbed Kai's elbow. Together, they hauled him up, an arm over each of their shoulders. They dragged him 4-5 steps toward the door.
He has another chip.
They paused. The advisor, still seated on the couch, still glaring, sneered as if irritated with himself.
What do you mean? There is a second tracking device embedded behind his right ear, in case anyone ever tried to kidnap him.
Allowing Aiko to take the brunt of Kai's weight, Cinder tentatively reached for his drooping head. She brushed his hair out of the way and pressed her fingers into the indent between his spine and skull. Something small and hard rested against the bone. She nodded at the advisor.
Thank you, she said, ejecting the knife again.
He grunted. If anything happens to him, Lin Mei, I will hunt you down and kill you myself.
A drop of sweat snaked its way down Cress's spine, but her hands were too busy to swipe at it. Her fingers flashed over the screens, skimming along lists and coding, triple-checking her work. The closed-circuit security system was down, including all cameras, scanners, identity-encoded software, and alarms. Both backup systems were disabled, and she could find no evidence of a third backup waiting to rise up and ruin all her hard work as soon as she turned away. The connection to the lunar spyware had been severed. She'd ensured that all digital locks in the North Tower were disabled, along with any doors in between this security control center and the research facility wing. She'd been extra diligent about disrupting the radar technology embedded in the rooftop's decorative Killin sculptures, so they wouldn't detect the Rampian's approach. All of the elevators were at a standstill, except the single elevator in the North Tower that was still stationed on the 14th floor, waiting for Cinder and Aiko to make their escape, which was taking forever. She inched her fingers away from the master screen and looked up. The dozens of screens surrounding her had gone black, but for the repeating gray text, system error.
That's it, she sat back. I think that's it.
No one was around to hear her. The glass wall separating her from Wolf and the rest of Sublevel D was soundproof, bulletproof, and probably many other types of proof that she didn't even know about. She pushed herself away from the desk. Wolf was out in the small lobby, leaning against the wall by the stairwell door. At some point, he'd removed his tuxedo jacket and bow tie, unbuttoned his collar, and rolled up his sleeves. His hair was no longer neat and tidy, but sticking up at odd angles. He looked bored. At his feet, scattered across the lobby floor, were at least 30 palace guards. He met Cress's gaze just as the door to the stairwell burst open and a guard charged through, gun raised. Cress screamed, but Wolf just grabbed the guard's arm, bent it behind his back, and targeted a precise hit to the side of his neck. The guard crumpled and Wolf slid him neatly onto the pile of his peers. Then he held his palms toward Cress, as if to ask what was taking so long.
Right, she murmured to herself, heart thumping. She inspected the screen with the elevator status reports one more time and saw that only one elevator was moving. Descending from the 14th floor in the North Tower. A smile trickled her lips, but was restrained behind the avalanche of anxiety.
Leaning over the control panel, she attached her port screen to the main input console and set the timer.
Dr. Erland watched the small screen on the machine's panel as it spit out a stream of data, documenting the stability of Thorne's stem cells, each step of the automated procedure, and the details of the chemical reaction that was happening on a cellular level inside the tiny plastic vial fitted into place. It was taking ages, but they weren't in any rush. Not yet. Behind him, Thorne was sitting on the lab table, kicking his heels against the side. The data stream lit up. Solution complete. Review parameters below. He made a quick scan of said parameters before allowing himself to feel pleased. Ejecting the vial, he reached for an eyedropper on the counter. Finished. Thorne pulled the blindfold down around his neck. Just like that? Your immune system will have to do the rest. We need to saturate your eyes 4 times a day for a week or so. Your vision should start returning after 6 or 7 days, but it will be gradual. Your body is practically engineering a new optical nerve, which doesn't happen overnight. Now, can you be a big boy and do the drops yourself? Thorne frowned. Really? You want us to come all this way just so I can stab myself in the eye? Sighing, the doctor dipped the dropper into the vial. Fine. Tilt your head back and keep your eyes open. 3 drops in each side. He reached forward, the clear solution bubbling up at the tip of the dropper and hovering over Thorne's wide-open eyes. But then, Dr. Erlon's attention caught on a bruise on the inside of his wrist. He froze and twisted his hand around to examine it. The bruise had formed around a dark red splotch, like blood puddled beneath the surface of his papery skin. His stomach dropped. Suddenly shaking, he inched away from Thorne and set the vial and the dropper on the counter. Thorne lowered his chin. What's wrong? Nothing, Dr. Erland murmured as he reached for a drawer and pulled out a face mask, snapping it on over his mouth and nose. Just double-checking something. He grabbed a sterilizer wash and wiped down the vial and the eyedropper, then wrapped them up in a cloth. He was feeling weak already, but that was no doubt all in his head. Even with the mutated disease, victims still survived anywhere from 24 to 48 hours after showing symptoms. At least. But he was an old man. And he'd been overexerting himself all day, with the walk through the escape tunnels and rushing through the palace. His immune system may already be strained. He glanced at Thorne, who had begun to whistle to himself.
I need to take a blood sample.
Thorne groaned.
Please don't tell me something got messed up.
No, just taking precautions. Your arm, please.
Thorne didn't look happy about it, but he rolled up his sleeve nevertheless. It was a quick test, one Dr. Erland had done 1,000 times, drawing the blood and running it through the diagnostic module to check for leptomycosis-carrying pathogens. Yet he found himself distracted by the warmth of his breaths as they caught inside the face mask. Thorne. And, if he returned with the others, Cinder. And his crescent moon. He gripped the side of the counter to keep his hands from shaking. Why hadn't he told her the truth before? He assumed they would have time. He'd believed there would be years after Celine was crowned and Lavanna was gone. Years to tell her the truth, to embrace her, to tell her how much he loved her, to apologize again and again for ever letting her go. He stared down at the bruise-like rash. Only a single bruise so far. It wasn't spreading, at least not on his arms, but his analytical brain, having seen this same rash on the wrists of so many victims, had already set a timer ticking. He was going to die. The module dinged, making him jump. Leptomycosis results? Negative. He shut his eyes in relief.
How's everything going over there, doctor?
He cleared his throat.
I've determined it would be best to let the stem cell solution sit for a few hours. You can apply the drops when you're back on the ship.
He picked up a stylus and began to type a message into the port screen.
I'll put the instructions on this port screen, just in case.
Instructions for who? His gut twisted as he wrote.
I won't be returning with you.
There was silence, punctuated by the tapping of the stylus and his own breaths, suddenly labored.
What are you talking about? I'm too old. I'll just slow you down. When the others arrive, I want you to go on without me.
Don't be stupid. We have a plan. We're sticking to it.
No. You'll be leaving me behind.
Why? So Lavanna can get her hands on you and torture you for information? Great idea.
She won't have time to torture me. I'm already dying.
The words pinched something inside him, and suddenly his spectacles were steaming up. There wasn't time. After all these years, there was never enough time.
What are you talking about?
He didn't respond until he'd finished typing into the port screen. Shoving the stylus behind his ear, he walked over to the door and peered through the small window into the laboratory corridor. Outside, dozens of guards had crowded into the hallway, stretching out in each direction with their guns raised.
All is indeed going according to plan, he muttered.
A hand landed on his shoulder, and he pulled away so fast he nearly collapsed into the counter.
Don't touch me!
What is going on? Said Thorne, growing impatient. Ducking around him, Dr. Erland paced to the other end of the room.
There is a quarantine room attached to this lab facility. I'll be quarantining myself. Don't worry, no one will dare come in to question me.
He removed his spectacles and rubbed the lenses on his shirt.
I've just diagnosed myself with letamosis.
Thorne launched himself away as if he'd been burned, planting his back against the wall so that there couldn't have been any more space between them. Cursing, he wiped the palm that had touched the doctor on his pants.
Don't worry, your results are negative. There is a very slim chance that you've caught it in the last 2 minutes.
He slid his spectacles back on.
Your stem cell solution is on the counter to your left, wrapped in a cloth. There is a port screen beside it. Give them to Cress. She can help you.
His voice clogged, and he felt for the keypad. The code hadn't changed since he'd left. As he pulled open the door, the lights in the quarantine flickered on. The window that divided the room was one way, so that the patients couldn't see the technicians while they were running tests. He had never been on that side of the glass before.
Carswell Thorne?
Glancing back, he saw that Thorne was still plastered against the wall, but the fear had left his expression, replaced with determination and sympathy.
Yes. Thank you for keeping her safe in the desert.
He knit his brows.
Although you still don't deserve her.
Before Thorne could respond, Dr. Erland stepped into the quarantine and shut himself in. His captivity was instant, airtight, and suffocating, and final. Chapter 53. She was glad that Wolf seemed to have memorized the palace blueprint better than she had, because with all this running up and down stairwells, around corners, and down countless corridors, Cress was completely lost. Wolf, however, hadn't shown a moment's hesitation as they ran down the abandoned halls.
Perfect timing, Wolf muttered under his breath, as they swung around another corner.
He grabbed Cress's elbow and yanked her back before she could collide with Cinder and Iko and the unconscious man hanging between them.
Well, hello there, strangers, said Iko.
Wolf nodded, first at Cinder, then the unconscious Emperor.
I thought that might be his cologne. Need help?
Neither Cinder nor Iko objected when he stooped down and swung Kai over one shoulder. If Cress hadn't been panicked and flustered and running on 8 quarts of throbbing adrenaline, she would have been much more impressed.
Labs are this way, Cinder said, taking the lead. Cress picked up her skirt and hurried after her. Any surprises?
Not so far, Cress answered. You?
Cinder shook her head as they darted across the sky bridge into the research wing.
Not really, just a lot of this.
A palace guard appeared in front of them, gripping his gun.
Stop right!
The word became a strangled gasp as his face went blank. His hands fell slack at his sides, the gun dropping to the floor. Kress gasped, but Cinder pulled her around his dazed form without breaking pace.
Wow, said Kress between her panting. Good thing you've been practicing, right?
I wish that were the reason it's so easy, she said, shaking her head as they rounded another corner.
With Wolf, at least there was some struggle, some effort involved, but with Earthens, it's too easy, she gulped. If she becomes Empress, Earth doesn't stand a chance.
They arrived at an elevator bank, and Kress punched in the override code.
Well then, she said, flashing a weary smile. Good thing she's not going to be Empress.
There seemed to be a mutual sigh as they crowded into the elevator. Kress's nerves were sparkling like a million electrodes. Sweat was soaking into the back of her expensive dress. She was frazzled from all the running and the stares and the panic. But at least they'd had a brief moment to pause and breathe and prepare themselves for what came next. Kress couldn't help sneaking a curious glance at the man draped over Wolf's shoulder. The Emperor. Of all the times she'd imagined meeting him after years of spying on him and his father, she'd never imagined their first meeting would be quite like this. Wolf stiffened as the elevator began to slow.
There's a lot of them out there.
We knew there would be, said Cinder. Thorne and the doctor had better be ready.
Kress shifted back, happy to keep Cinder and Wolf between her and whatever awaited them in the hall. Aiko bent toward her.
That dress looks amazing on you, she said. Cinder, doesn't she look amazing?
Cinder sighed as the elevator came to a full stop.
Aiko, after this, we're going to start working on occasion appropriateness.
The door slid open, and dozens of palace guards in red and gold uniforms stood before them.
And not an android among them, Cinder muttered.
Kai and I are going to have a long talk about palace security. She marched into the corridor. You, she ordered without gesturing to anyone in particular as far as Kress could tell, are now our personal guard. Form a barrier. 8 guards shuffled forward and, in robotic unison, formed a wall between them and their peers. Confusion flashed through the eyes of the others. Cinder held her palm out, and one of the guards set a gun into it, handle first. She aimed it at Kai's head, her expression the picture of cold neutrality.
If anyone thinks of getting in our way, your emperor is dead. Now move.
With their 8 personal guards acting as a protective bubble around them, Kress found herself being herded along with the others toward the lab rooms. When they reached the 6th door, Cinder knocked, using the special rhythm they'd devised. The door swung open a beat later. Thorne was flushed and scowling. He had his cane in one hand, a cloth bundle in the other, and his blindfold still on.
Doctor's not coming, he said.
A hesitation before Cinder said,
What do you mean he's not coming?
He gestured toward the back of the lab, and they all pushed inside, leaving Cinder's brainwashed puppets to linger, baffled, in the hallway. A window was set into the wall, showing a sterile quarantine room. The doctor was seated on top of a lab table, his head hanging down, his fingers fidgeting with his hat. With a growl, Cinder marched up to the window and pounded on it with her fist. The doctor lifted his head, messy gray hair sticking out in all directions. Grabbing a microphone from the desk, Cinder pushed a button and screamed,
We don't have time for this! Get out here!
The doctor only smiled, sadly.
Cinder, said Thorne, his tone heavy in a way Kress had rarely heard. He has the plague.
Kress's stomach dropped as Cinder reeled back from the window. The doctor smoothed down his hair.
Has everyone made it back safely?
He asked, his voice coming through some speaker in the wall. It took Cinder a moment, but then she stammered.
Yes, everyone but you.
A hand landed on Kress's head. She gasped and recoiled, but Thorne was already wrapping his arm around her shoulders and squeezing her against him.
Just checking it was you, he whispered.
She blinked up at his profile.
The hours they'd spent apart suddenly felt like days, and she realized it could as easily have been him that was being left behind, instead of the doctor. She dug herself further into his embrace.
"I am sorry," said Dr. Erland, the words crisply spoken, like he'd been waiting to say them.
He looked more fragile than ever sitting on the lab table, his face carved with wrinkles.
"Miss Lynn, Mr. Wolf," he sighed. "Crescent."
Her eyes widened. No one had called her that since Sybil. How had he even known? It was a common name on Luna. Perhaps it was a lucky guess.
"I've hurt you all in some way, been at least partially responsible for some tragedy in your lives. I am sorry."
Cress gulped, feeling a twinge of regret in the base of her stomach. The doctor still wore a bruise on his jaw from where she'd hit him.
"I've made some important discoveries," said the doctor. "How much time can you spare?"
Cinder's hand tightened around the microphone. "Jason's ETA is in 6 minutes.
"That will have to suffice."
The sorrow on the old man's face hardened.
"Is His Majesty with you?"
"He's unconscious," said Cinder. His eyebrows lifted almost imperceptibly.
"I see. Would you be so kind as to pass on a message to him?"
Before Cinder could respond, the doctor pulled on his hat and inhaled a deep breath.
"This plague is not a random tragedy. It is biological warfare."
"What?" Cinder planted her hands on the desk. "What do you mean?"
"The Lunar Crown has been using antibodies found in the blood of the ungifted to manufacture an antidote for the last 16 years, and perhaps much longer. But 16 years ago, Letamosis didn't even exist, unless it, too, had been manufactured in a lunar laboratory. Lunars wanted to weaken Earth and to create a dependency on their antidote."
He patted his chest, as if looking for something in his pocket, but then seemed to realize it was missing.
"Right. I've indicated my findings on the port screen that is now in Mr. Thorne's possession. Please give it to His Majesty when he is recovered. Earth should know that this war did not start with the recent attacks. This war has been going on beneath our noses for over a decade, and I do fear Earth is losing."
The silence that followed was suffocating. Cinder leaned down into the microphone.
"We're not going to lose."
"I believe you, Miss Lynn."
The doctor's breath shuddered.
"Now, would Cress come closer, please?"
Cress stiffened. She pressed against Thorne's side as the others all looked at her, and it was only his gentle nudge that unstuck her feet. She crept toward the window that divided them from the quarantine room. Only now, as she came to stand before the microphone, did she realize it was a one-way window. She could see the doctor, but on the other side he was probably looking at a reflection of himself. Cinder cleared her throat, not taking her curious gaze off Cress. "She's here." A pathetic smile tried to climb up the doctor's lips, but failed.
"Crescent. My crescent moon."
"How do you know my full name?" she asked, too confused to recognize the harshness of her tone. But the doctor did not seem fazed, even as his lips began to tremble.
"Because I named you."
She shivered, clawing her hands into the folds of her skirt.
"I want you to know that it nearly killed me when I lost you, and I have thought of you every day."
His gaze hovered somewhere near the base of the window.
"I always wanted to be a father, even as a young man. But I was recruited into the Crown's team of scientists immediately following my education. Such an honor, you know. My career became everything, and there was no time for a family. I was already in my 40s when I married, my wife another scientist whom I'd known for many years and never thought I liked very much until she decided that she liked me. She was not much younger than me, and the years passed, and I'd given up hope until, one day,
She was pregnant.
A chill slipped down Cress's spine. It felt like listening to an old, sad tale, one that she was removed from, one that she felt she knew the ending to, but denial kept a distance between her and the doctor's words.
We did all the right things. We decorated a nursery, we planned a celebration, and sometimes at night, she would sing an old lullaby, one that I'd forgotten over the years, and we decided to call you our little crescent moon.
His voice broke on the last word, and he slumped over, scratching at his hat. Cress gulped. The window, the sterile room, the man with a dark blue rash all began to blur in front of her.
Then you were born, and you were a shell.
His words slurred.
And Sybil came, and I begged her not to take you, but there was nothing. She wouldn't, and I thought you were dead. I thought you were dead, and all along you were. If I'd known, Crescent, if I'd known, I never would have left. I would have found a way to save you. I'm so sorry for everything.
He hid his face as sobs racked his body. Pressing her lips together, Cress shook her head, wanting to deny it all, but how could she when he knew her name? And she had his eyes, and a tear slipped past her eyelashes, rolling hot down her cheek. Her father was alive. Her father was dying. Her father was here, in front of her, almost in arm's reach. But he would be left here to die, and she would never see him again. Cool metal brushed against her wrist, and Cress jumped.
I'm so sorry, Cinder said,
retracting her hand.
But we have to leave. Dr. Erlund. I know. Yes, I know.
He swiped hastily to clear his face. When he lifted his head, his cheeks were flushed, his eyes glassy. He looked as weak and frail as a broken bird.
I'm so sorry. This is how. Oh, please be careful. Please be safe. My crescent moon, I love you. I do love you.
Her lungs hiccuped as more tears dripped off her jaw, dotting her silk skirt. She opened her mouth, but no words came.
I love you. I love you too.
Words that had been so easy in daydreams and now seemed impossible. She believed him, but she didn't know him. She didn't know if she loved him back.
Cress, said Cinder, tightening her grip. I'm sorry, but we have to go.
She nodded dumbly.
Good. Goodbye,
she said, the only words that would come, as she was dragged away from the window. On the other side of the glass, the doctor sobbed. He did not look up again, but he raised a shaking hand in farewell. The tips of his fingers were shriveled and blue.
Chapter 54. They abandoned their entourage of guards in the elevator on the top floors. No one cared that it would be too easy to deduce where they were heading. Hopefully, by the time anyone snapped out of Cinder's brainwashing, they'd be long gone. The research wing's emergency service elevator was kept on its own, in an alcove tucked away from the rest of the wing. It was their final obstacle, and Cress had taken care to ensure it would be functioning properly when they arrived. She stumbled ahead of them to punch in the code, emotionally drained. It felt as if her brain were churning through sludge, and it took her a moment to remember the code at all. The elevator opened, and they crowded inside. No one spoke, whether out of respect for Dr. Erlund or out of a tenuous hope that they were so close, so very close. The doors opened onto the roof. Dusk was climbing over the city, glistening off the palace windows and coating the landing pad in purple shadows. And the Rampian was there. Its ramp lowered toward them.
Cress laughed, an abrupt, delirious laugh that felt like it was being ripped out of her throat. Aiko let out a victorious whoop and ran for the ramp, screaming, "We did it!" Thorn's grip tightened on Cress's arm.
"He's here. He's here,"
she whispered back. Wolf alone slowed down, baring his teeth. Kai was still draped over his shoulder.
"Jason, ready for takeoff! Now!" Cinder yelled toward the ship. "Where?"
Her words fell short, and she slowed, then stopped altogether. Cress gasped and locked her hands around Thorn's arm, holding him back. A figure appeared at the top of the cargo bay ramp. Her white coat and long sleeves made her look like a ghost haunting their ship, blocking their way to freedom. Cress's instincts screamed at her to run, to hide, to get as far away from Mistress Sybil as she could. But when she glanced behind her, she saw that the Thaumaturge wasn't alone. Half a dozen lunar guards had crowded in behind them, blocking off their path to the elevator. The elevator that wouldn't have worked anyway. She'd programmed it to shut down once they reached the rooftop so that no one could follow them. It wouldn't work again until the timer she'd set on the security mainframe ticked down and the system rebooted itself. Which meant they had no place to run, no place to hide. They were 40 steps from their ship, and they were trapped. Cinder's momentary elation evaporated as she looked up at the Thaumaturge. She should have sensed her immediately, her and the guards, before she'd even stepped off the elevator. But she'd been so distracted with the sensation of success. She'd gotten cocky, and now they were surrounded.
"What a lovely reunion," said Sybil, her sleeves snapping in the rooftop wind. "Had I known you were all going to come to me, I wouldn't have wasted half as much energy attempting to find you."
Cinder tried to keep her focus on Sybil as she took stock of her allies. Wolf was slightly in front of her, snarling as he set Kai on the ground. Though he wasn't showing any pain, she could see a small spot of blood on Wolf's dress shirt. His stitches must have come undone, reopening the wound. Aiko wasn't far from him, the only one of them not panting. Cress and Thorn were to Cinder's left. Thorn had a cane and, she thought, he might still have his gun, too. But he and Wolf could easily become liabilities, weapons to be toyed with by the Thaumaturge, unlike Cress and Aiko, who couldn't be controlled.
"How many?"
Thorn asked.
"Mistress Sybil in front of us," said Cress, "and 6 lunar guards behind."
After the slightest hesitation, Thorn nodded.
"I accept those odds." "So charming," said Sybil, tilting her head.
"My little protege has been embraced by cyborgs and androids and criminals, the scum of earthen society. Quite fitting for a useless shell."
From the corner of her eye, Cinder noticed Thorn easing himself as a shield between Cress and the Thaumaturge. But it was Cress who lifted her chin, with a look more confident than Cinder had ever seen on her.
"You mean the useless shell that just disconnected the link to all your palace surveillance equipment?"
Sybil clicked her tongue.
"Arrogance doesn't suit you, dear. What do I care if the connection has been severed? Soon, this palace will be the home of Queen Levana."
She nodded.
"Guards, leave His Majesty and the Special Operative unharmed. Kill the rest."
Cinder heard the thunk of boots, the rustle of uniforms, the click of guns being released from their holsters. She opened her thoughts to them. 6 lunar men, 6 royal guards who, just like Jason, had been trained to keep their minds open, trained to be puppets. She sought out the electric pulses around them. In unison, all 6 guards turned toward the edge of the rooftop and threw their guns as hard as they could. 6 handguns sailed out of sight, clattering somewhere on the tiled rooftops below. Sybil let out a screech of laughter, the most unrestrained Cinder had ever witnessed from her.
"You have learned a few things since we last saw each other, haven't you?"
Sybil paced down the ramp.
"Not that controlling a handful of guards is any impressive feat."
Her gaze flickered to Wolf. Abandoning the guards, Cinder reached out for him instead, bracing herself for the sharp burst of pain inside her head that happened every time she took control of Wolf. But the pain didn't come. Wolf's mind was already closed to her, as if someone had locked his writhing energy up in a vault. Then he swiveled toward Cinder, his face contorting with a feral hunger. Cursing, Cinder took half a step back. Her memory flashed to all the duels inside the cargo bay, and then Wolf launched himself at her. Ducking, Cinder held her hands toward his abdomen and used his momentum to flip him over her head. He landed lithely on his feet and spun back, aiming a right hook for her jaw. Cinder deflected with her metal fist, but the force drove her off balance and she fell onto the hard asphalt of the landing pad. Planting both hands on the ground, she drove her heel up toward Wolf, catching him in the side, his wounded side. She hated herself for it, but he grunted in pain and stumbled half a step back. She sprang back to her feet. She was already panting. Warnings flooded her retina display. Wolf licked his lips as he prepared to charge for her a second time, revealing the glint of his sharp teeth. Smothering her panic, Cinder tried to reach for him again. If only she could break Sybil's mental hold. If only she'd gotten to him first. She searched for some flicker of the wolf she knew was encased inside all that fury and bloodlust, some vulnerable spot in his mind. She was so distracted by her attempts to dislodge Sybil's control that she didn't notice the roundhouse kick until it had crashed into the side of her head and sent her reeling halfway across the platform. She lay on her side, dizzy, white sparks flashing in her vision, and her left arm burning from skidding across the ground. Breath wouldn't come into her lungs. She couldn't lift her head. Programming diagnostics were going berserk, and it took her a moment to remember how to send them away so she could focus. As her vision cleared, she noticed shapes moving against the twilight sky. People in shadows, fighting, brawling. The hazy images were eventually coupled with grunts of pain. The guards had attacked. Thorn had gotten a knife from somewhere. Cress was wildly swinging his cane, and Aiko was using her metal and silicon limbs as best she could to defend herself. But Thorn was blind, and Aiko wasn't programmed with fighting skills, and as soon as one of the guards grabbed the cane out of Cress's hands, she fell to her knees, paralyzed, cowering behind her arms. As Cinder watched, a guard caught Thorn's wrist and yanked it behind his back. He cried out. The knife fell. Another guard landed a punch to his stomach. Then Cinder heard a growl. Wolf was crouched, ready to come at her again. Cinder resisted the urge to close her eyes and brace for impact, instead letting a slow breath out through her nose. She urged her muscles to relax with it. Your mind and body have to work together. For a moment, it was like being two people at once. Her eyes were open, focused on Wolf as he lunged for her, and her body, loose, unrelaxed, instinctively rolled away before she bounced back to her feet. At the same time, her lunar gift sought out the pulses of energy around her, targeted the six guards, and wrapped so tightly around them it was like clasping them in enormous metal fists. There was a jolt of surprise from the guards. One crashed to his knees, two fell onto their sides, convulsing. Cinder dodged another punch, blocked another kick. Her instincts yearned to use the knife inside her finger, but she refused. Wolf wasn't the enemy. She landed an uppercut to his jaw, her first solid strike as those words infiltrated her brain. Wolf isn't the enemy. A blur of blue caught her eye. Aiko jumped onto Wolf's back with a battle cry, wrapping her legs around his waist. Her arms surrounded his head, trying to blind or suffocate or distract him any way she could. She was successful for 2.3 seconds before Wolf reached behind him, grabbed hold of her head, and twisted with such force the skin ripped around her throat. The wiring along her upper spine popped and sparked. Aiko slipped off him, crumpling to the ground. Her legs were twisted awkwardly beneath her. The external plating that protected her collar structure was peeled back on one side, revealing disconnected wires and a torn muscle pad, already leaking thick yellow silicon down her shoulder. Cinder stumbled and crashed to her knees, staring at the crooked form. Her internal audio latched onto that awful sound and began replaying it over and over. That same brutal snap. That same heavy thud as Aiko's body hit the ground. Her stomach heaved once, but she kept it down as she peeled her gaze away from Aiko and looked, not at Wolf, but at Sybil. The thaumaturge was standing at the base of the ramp now. Her beautiful face was pinched in concentration. In her distant thoughts, Cinder could tell that the guards were picking themselves off the ground, rounding on her friends again. Snarling, she ignored them all. She ignored Wolf. Sybil was the enemy. Wolf turned back to face her. His feet pounded on the pavement, but Cinder was too focused on the bioelectricity rolling off Sybil to care. Sybil's energy was twisted and arrogant and proud, and Cinder had just slipped into the cracks of her thoughts when the impact came. Wolf crashed into her, knocking her over, but Cinder barely felt it. While Wolf pinned her to the ground, Cinder was working her way around Sybil's gift, becoming intimately acquainted with how the energy rippled along her limbs and fingers, how it was so different from the way the same energy churned and throbbed inside her brain. As Wolf revealed his sharp canines, Cinder discovered where Sybil's gift was boiling hot in her attempts to control Wolf, leaving the rest of her brain cool and vulnerable. When Wolf lowered his fangs toward Cinder's unprotected throat, Cinder seized Sybil's mind and attacked. Chapter 55. Crack. Kress glanced up just as Aiko slid off Wolf's back, landing broken and mangled on the hard ground. A shudder tore through her. Even from this distance, she could see the torn flesh and sparking wires.
What was that?
She returned her attention to Thorn. She was still kneeling beside him, trying to steady him as best she could. He'd taken a hard punch to his stomach that had knocked the wind from him, but at least he was breathing and talking again.
I think we just lost Aiko, she said. Can you stand?
Thorn groaned, still clasping one hand to his stomach.
Yeah,
he said, sounding none too convinced. Something shuffled. Glancing up, Kress squeaked and dug her fingers into Thorn's arms. The guards, having been paralyzed and empty-faced for the past few moments, were twitching. One of them groaned. Beside her, Thorn pulled himself to his feet.
There, better, he said, though he was still grimacing. Do you see my cane anywhere, or my knife?
She spotted a cane behind one of the guards, whose furious gaze was no longer empty or harmless.
Kress.
Guards are up again,
she said. Thorn flinched.
All six of them?
She glanced over her shoulder.
And Cinder's on the ground. She might be unconscious, and Wolf's still under Sybil's control, and I think he's going to—
She squeezed Thorn's arm, horrified at the sight of Wolf pinning Cinder to the ground. She wanted to look away, but couldn't, like being stuck in a bad dream.
That all sounds very dire, said Thorn.
Shivering, she pressed her back against him, wondering how her death was going to come. Her skull crushed against the concrete, her neck snapped like Aiko's.
I guess it's time.
While Kress's thoughts continued to churn through the horrible things that could happen to her, she felt herself being suddenly spun around and dipped backwards, a supportive arm scooping beneath her back. She yelped and caught herself on Thorn's shoulder. Then, he was kissing her. The battle became a hurricane, with them caught in the eye, his arms cradling her against the wind, her skirt billowing around his legs, his lips gentle but coaxing, as if they had all the time in the world. Warmth overtook her, and Kress closed her eyes. She thought her arms wanted to wrap around his neck, but her whole body was vibrating and dizzy, and she could barely keep her fingers clutched around the fabric of his shirt. She had just finished melting when she was suddenly righted again. The world flipped. Thorn spun, embracing her against his chest with one arm, while the other reached for his waist. Kress heard the gunshot and screamed, pressing herself against him, before she realized that Thorn was the one who had fired. A guard grunted. Another guard grabbed Thorn by the collar, and he turned, elbowing the guard in the jaw.
Kress, do me a favor.
He twirled her around so that her back was against him. She was beginning to feel like a satellite being constantly spun out of orbit, but she had no time to think as Thorn settled his arm around her shoulder.
Make sure I don't shoot anyone we like.
He fired again, and the bullet clipped a guard's bicep. The guard barely flinched and lunged toward them. Gasping, Cress wrapped her hands around Thorne's and aimed. He fired again, this time hitting the guard in the chest. He stumbled backward and fell. Cress swiveled, pulling Thorne's hand toward the next guard. Another shot to the chest. A third shot hit the next guard's shoulder. She aimed for the fourth. Click, click. Thorne cursed.
Well, that was fun while it lasted.
The guard laughed. He was tall and made of muscle, with orange-red hair that swept nearly straight up, and he was the only guard that Cress recognized. She'd seen him on the surveillance footage before, usually along with the rest of the Queen's entourage, which meant he was probably the highest-ranking guard among them.
"If it's all right with you," he said, "I'll be killing you now."
"Aren't you a gentleman?" Thorne said, pulling Cress behind him and raising his fists. A scream split through the wind. Not just a scream, but a scream made up of pain and delirium, torture and agony. Cress and Thorne both ducked and covered their ears. And at first, Cress was terrified that it was Cinder. But when she looked, Mistress Sybil had fallen on the ground and was twitching and digging her nails into her scalp. The scream went on and on as she twisted and flailed, craning her head so fast it smacked against the asphalt, then curling up on herself like a fetus, searching for relief that wasn't coming. Cinder still appeared unconscious, with Wolf hovering over her, but then he whipped his head like a bedraggled dog and sprang away from Cinder with wild, remorseful eyes. Cinder stayed corpse-like on the ground.
"Stop!"
the red-haired guard yelled. He grabbed Cress, yanking her away from Thorne and wrapping one hand around her throat. She screamed and clawed at his wrists, but he didn't seem to notice.
"I said stop, or I'll crush her throat!"
Though he was yelling, he could hardly be heard over Sybil, and either Cinder didn't hear him, or she didn't care. Or she couldn't stop. Cress tried to kick behind her, but her legs were too short, and already darkness was encroaching on her vision. Crack. The guard's fist loosened, and he toppled over, unconscious. Cress stumbled away from him, rubbing her neck. Spinning around, she saw Thorne holding his cane like a club.
"I found my cane," he said, tossing it once with a twirl and trying to catch the other end, but missing.
The cane clattered to the floor. Thorne flinched.
"Are you all right?"
She gulped, ignoring how it burned in her throat.
Yes.
Good. Thorne picked up the cane again. "Now, what in the name of spades is all the screaming about?"
"I don't know. Cinder's doing something to Mistress Sybil. Something with her gift."
"Well, it's annoying and we're running out of time. Come on." One of the guards they'd shot reached out for Cress's ankle as she passed, but she kicked at him as they ran for Cinder. Wolf was shaking her, but she wasn't responding. Behind them, Sybil's screams tapered into uncontrollable blubbering as she convulsed on the ground.
"Maybe Cinder has to be rebooted," said Thorne, after Cress had described the situation as well as she could.
That happened once before. Here." He reached beneath Cinder's head, and Cress heard a click. Cinder's eyes popped open, and her hand snapped around Thorne's wrist. Crying out, he fell over onto the ground. Sybil's sobs dwindled to whimpering.
"Don't open my control panel," she said, releasing Thorne.
She shut the plate in her head.
"Then stop going comatose on me." He stood up. "Can we go now before the entire Commonwealth military shows up?"
Cinder sat up, blinking.
"Iko." "Right. Wolf, could you get the android, please? And the Emperor? I trust he's still around here somewhere."
The Emperor. In the chaos, Cress had forgotten all about him.
"Sirens."
Cress looked at Wolf. His head was cocked to one side.
"Heading this direction."
"Which means the military won't be far behind," said Cinder. "I take it there's no sign of Jason?" No one responded. There had been no sign of their gateway pilot since the fight had started. Cress licked her lips. Had he betrayed them? Had he told Sybil about their plan?
"Figures," said Cinder. "Thorne, you're with me in the cockpit. Jason and I practice takeoffs. Once. You can help jog my memory."
Together, they hurried to carry Iko's broken body and Kai, still unconscious, into the cargo bay. Then, they heard laughter. High, strained laughter that dropped ice down Cress's spine. Sybil was struggling to stand. She made it to her feet and took a couple wobbling steps before falling back down to one knee. She laughed again and bunched her fists into her long, unruly hair. Cress was suddenly pushed aside as Wolf trudged down the ramp and grasped Sybil by the front of her white coat, yanking her toward him. Her eyes rolled back into her head.
"Where is she?" he yelled. "Is she still alive?"
Even from the top of the ramp, Cress could see the hatred burning in his eyes, overshadowed only by his need to know. To be given any sliver of hope that Scarlet was still out there, that he still had a chance to save her. But Sybil's head only collapsed to one side.
"What? What pretty birds,"
she said, before she was overcome with a fit of incoherent giggles. Wolf snarled, baring his teeth. For a moment, his entire body was shaking, and Cress thought he was going to tear her throat out. But then he dropped Sybil to the ground. She fell hard, whimpered from the impact, and rolled onto her back. Then she started to laugh again, staring up at the sky. The sun was just setting, but the full moon had already risen high over the city's skyline. Turning away from her, Wolf marched up the ramp. He did not meet Cress's gaze as he passed her. Cress stared, bewildered, as Sybil raised both arms up toward the sky, cackling, cackling. The ramp started to rise, slowly blocking the sight of Sybil and the bleeding guards who were scattered around the rooftop. The roar of the engines soon drowned out both the mad laughter and the sirens blaring beyond the palace walls. Chapter 56. To anyone who would have seen her, Lavanna was a vision of serenity in her ethereal red wedding gown and the sheer gold veil that fell to her wrists. She sat on the settee in her guest quarters, posture perfect, her hands folded in her lap. Except they were not folded at all, but rather balled into angry fists. Each one held a wedding band, one that she had worn for far too many years, that she had once believed would bring her love and happiness, but had only ever brought her pain. The other was supposed to bring her not the love of a blind, selfish husband, but the love of an entire planet. She should have been wearing it now. Everything had been going so well. She had been moments away from walking down that aisle. Moments away. She should have been married. She should have been reciting the vows that would make her empress. When she found out who was responsible for this delay, she would torment their fragile mind until they were a drooling, pathetic idiot, terrified of the sight of their own hands. A knock cut through the fantasy. Lavanna shifted her eyes toward the door.
"Enter."
One of the guards entered first, escorting Khan Torin, the young emperor's annoying, perpetually present advisor. She glared at him through her gold veil, though she knew he couldn't see it.
"Your illustrious majesty,"
he said, bowing deeply. The addition of a new adjective combined with the bow slightly lower than usual made the hair prickle on the back of her neck.
"I must apologize most severely for the delay and for the news I have to impart to you. We have been forced, I'm afraid, to postpone the marriage ceremony."
"I do beg your pardon."
He straightened, but kept his gaze respectfully on the floor.
"His Imperial Majesty, Emperor Kaito, has been kidnapped. He was taken from his personal quarters and smuggled onto an untraceable spaceship."
Her fingers curled around the wedding bands.
"By whom?"
"Lin Cinder, Your Majesty, the cyborg fugitive from the ball, along with multiple accomplices, it would appear."
Lin Cinder. Every time she heard the name, she wanted to spit.
"I see," she said, finding it too wearisome to soften the hardness of her anger.
"Am I to believe that you did not have any security measures in place for the attempt of such an assault?" "Our security was compromised."
"Compromised?"
"Yes, Your Majesty."
She rose to her feet. The gown swished like a breeze around her hips. The advisor didn't flinch, although he should have.
"You're telling me that this teenage girl
has not only escaped from your prison and evaded capture by your highly trained military, but has now invaded your palace and the private quarters of the Emperor himself, kidnapped him, and again gotten away with it?
Precisely correct, Your Majesty.